A Silicon Valley legend has finally written a book about his experiences and success. And this week on Techonomics, he speaks with host Jason Middleton about why this book and why now. Taking a company from millions a year to tens of billions a year starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. We've been fond of the tech billionaire story for a while. We're a little less fond these days, though. Silicon Valley and tech in general has been an unregulated Wild West this century, and while that may be fading, it is helpful to look at iconic leaders from the past and how they steered their companies through volatility. One such icon is John Chambers. He's the former CEO and now chairman emeritus at Cisco. When Mr. Chambers, and he would prefer John, onboarded at Cisco, the company was a simple router company that he guided to become a backbone of the internet. Here's an example of how to successfully scale a business. At the beginning of his Cisco career in 1990, it had $70 million in annual revenue. When he left in 2014, the annual rev was $47 billion. And the man had a plan when it came to that growth. Build internally, but also buy externally. And by the way, John is from West Virginia, and you're going to hear about that a lot.
A phone call on a Thursday night from the head of the NASDAQ that said, John, you're missing something very bad here. I'm surprised. And he told me the name of a company I should buy. I didn't even know him. But by Monday morning, we announced the acquisition of a $3 billion acquisition through the market. And my competitors had been in there for 6 to 12 months before that. They never knew what hit them.
For the first time, John Chambers has written a book that shares the lessons from his legendary Silicon Valley career. Here we go.
John Chambers, founder and CEO of JC2 Ventures.
Yeah, well, you have a long and storied career that we want to get into too, Mr. Chambers, but you and I have crossed paths with one commonality, and that is we are both native West Virginians, and that plays a big role in your book and in your approach too. Can we talk a little bit about that? How did you take what you took from your accomplished parents and family into the business world?
Well, first of all, you've got to call me John because, you know, in West Virginians, we're mountaineers for life, and I'm a huge believer we're all equal in life. So first name, if you would, be okay.
Yes, sir.
Jason would be awesome. And in terms of West Virginian lessons learned, I literally opened up the book with an example of how you either disrupt or you get disrupted, and West Virginia being an example of that. But also lessons learned very early on. I almost drowned at the age of 6 years old in a river called Elk River, West Virginia. And I was fishing with my dad, and he had warned me about getting too far out in the rocks and getting swept away into the rapids, and you could literally drown there. And sure enough, I didn't listen well, and I fell in. And as I was going down through the rapids, I started to panic, and he was yelling at me to hold on to the fishing pole, hold on to the fishing pole. Each time I had surface spinning water, I could see him run down the edge and hold on to the fishing pole. It's an ugly fishing pole, Jason. It might have cost $5, but if he was concerned about the fishing pole, I held on to it with both hands, and he got down below me, pulled me out of the water, set me over to the side, and said, taught me lessons once I got relaxed about when you're in a very tough situation, don't try to swim against the current. Don't panic. Focus on how do you navigate through it and get out. And then he put me back into the water and go down through the same area on my own. I don't think he told my mom that, but he taught me early on how do you deal with the challenges in life. West Virginians were basically good people. Yet if I were to ever run off the road in the middle of the night and have to go up and knock on somebody's door and ask for help, I would hope I'd be in West Virginia because they would help. So very proud of the state. A lot of lessons learned. Also learned it was the chemical center of the world and the coal center of the world. 6,000 of the top chemical engineers with Carbide and DuPont and FMC. Mm-hmm. We lost our way.
Mm-hmm.
Same lesson, Boston 128. They lost their way and Silicon Valley emerged. There is no guarantee Silicon Valley will be in leadership role a decade from now unless we continue to invent and continue to change.
And a quick contextual point for the near drowning, someone that you knew actually did drown at later time in that same area. So this was not a joke. This is obviously obviously a deadly part of Elk River. You mentioned there...
It was. He was 16 years old or so at the time, and a much stronger swimmer than I would have been.
You have been, during your business career, and we're going to pretty much dwell on Cisco here, although it is varied, and we're going to talk a little bit about your ventures right now, but you've been a very steady hand on the till when it comes to running, but you've also had this secret sauce of being able to see where not just a market opportunity might be, but where a market evolution is going to happen. How can you forecast so well forward?
Well, I learned it the hard way in West Virginia and in Boston 128 with the mini computer industry, where we were the Silicon Valley of the world. Once you've watched that occur, you're now listening, and I almost always get my trends from customers. The customers told me to move from an area called routing into switching. And when we did that, and we did it through acquisitions, most people thought acquisitions would fail in the early 90s because almost all of them had. And our stock went down when I made our first move for an acquisition, which later generated $13 billion in revenue per year. It's having the courage to listen to those customers, connecting the dots, and then saying, how does it play together? And instead of building products that were in silos, build products that work together, knocking down the silos to focus on outcomes. So the internet changing the way you work, live, learn, and play, as opposed to building a router which moved data around. And then it's constantly listening to customers. They, out of the 180 acquisitions we did, all of them were customer-driven. Only one Steve Jobs. He just knew what to build, but it took him 7 years.
Right.
And he truly was amazing and definitely the exception. What I did was listen to who Ford told me to buy, who Boeing told me to drive by, who Time Warner told me to buy, et cetera. And that's how we made our acquisition decisions, including a phone call on a Thursday night from the head of the NASDAQ that said, John, you're missing something very bad here. I'm surprised. And he told me the name of a company I should buy. I didn't even know him. But by Monday morning, we announced the acquisition of a $3 billion acquisition through the market. And my competitors had been in there for 6 to 12 months before that. They never knew what hit them. So a replicatable innovation playbook combined with seeing market transitions.
John, I have to put your career up next to Jack Welch's and some other turnaround kings, if you will. But at the same time, I was wondering why this book right now. We're speaking with John Chambers, by the way, chairman emeritus at Cisco, former CEO at Cisco, took the revenue from $70 million when he inherited, dropped it off at $47 billion annually. The book is called Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World. Why this book right now, John?
Well, because as I began to realize the change that was occurring in the world, big companies are going to shed jobs because of digitization and automation. 20 to 40% of the jobs that we know them today will disappear. That means job creation in the future will be small companies getting bigger and startups. And it means if you only do it in Silicon Valley and only do it in New York, we're going to leave behind the majority of our country. And I'm doing this not only in our country, but also in France and India with President Macron in France and with Prime Minister Modi in India, where both nations are focused on startups. As I traveled around the world, it didn't matter if I was in Dubai or Paris or New York or Austin or Silicon Valley or New Delhi, the questions were very similar. And then everybody wanted to delve into the stories behind it and saying, John, tell us the stories and then summarize it. And they kept pushing me to write a book because they said, if you want to do it on scale, you should. So I decided to do it. So trying to change the world in my own way one more time. Was fortunate enough to play a role in that with the internet and see if we can do it on a truly startup nation, startup states, startup world.
John, I kind of expected that answer because you're not a vainglorious kind of person. It's not a vanity project. You don't need a lead generator either for your new and your VC ventures, that is. Tell me more about what you're doing in France. I'm a huge fan of the radical centrist who is Emmanuel Macron.
I think he's the future for Europe. What will be interesting is, will the French people have the courage to disrupt themselves? And that's yet to be seen. What I'm doing in France, it surprised me. I thought the startup nation in Europe would be the UK, and it was not. And then I thought it would be Germany. I met with the leaders in both countries, and it was not. Then I met with a socialistic government in France, of all places, where I did not expect a startup nation to occur, and they were willing to change. And I saw them at the Consumer Electronics Show, must have been almost 4.5 years ago. And suddenly they were changing. There were 66 companies there, and I asked them how many of them were there the year before, only 38 companies. I see that connecting the dots, the patterns. And when I sat down with them, what was amazing, Jason, it was like I was in Silicon Valley in terms of their questions that they asked me, except with a funny accent. long story short, France has moved from a terrible place to do business, about 120 to 140 high-tech venture-backed companies per year, to 743 last year. This is at a time the U.S. is actually within 2 years of a 20-year low. So we've got to get this going again. But why France? I think they're going to be the innovation center for Europe. Also, it's so important to play a small role helping the country if they want to change to really disrupt. And as you know, when you disrupt countries or a state, there's often challengers.
I was lucky enough to be in Paris during the election in France. And one of the first things he did after getting in office was create that high-tech corridor with special breaks if you build in Paris. I follow your lead on this very, very well. You mentioned disruption of states, though, too. John, have you considered running for governor? Because it seems to me of West Virginia, because it seems to me that the stasis in West Virginia really kind of lands on the political class.
Well, it's interesting. First, I want to thank the people who are willing to run for any public office, because we're brutal on them, whether they're successful or not. But Shimon Peres, the prior president of Israel, taught me many years ago. He said, John, you can have more an influence on the future of a state or a country coming from the business side with innovation and using your skills there than you can as a political leader. And he was right. I did think about running for governor of California almost 14 years ago, and then maybe potentially doing something on a national stage. But I'm different than most. I like Democrats and Republicans. I'm a moderate. I like immigration, and I believe in choice. And I want to see our nation come together. I think perhaps I can have more of an influence doing that from a position of startups and a champion for startups, which is part of what this book's about, and doing it inclusive and getting a model that works across all 50 states so we don't leave behind the heartland of America. So the answer to your question is no, government is not in my future.
All right. Thank you for that answer, John. My time with you, unfortunately, is limited. I kind of want to ask you a macro capitalist question. How many of those acquisitions did you make while at Cisco? 180, I understand. How many have those happened after the financial crisis?
After 2008 or 2001?
Let's call it 2008.
Probably about a fourth.
Okay.
It's pretty consistent all the way through the 90s and 2000, and then the current leadership have continued to keep on an acquisition strategy. Your takeaway here is very simple. Replicatable acquisition playbook, best in the industry, took risk, told the market a third would fail. When they failed, we still got beat up. That's part of leadership on it. But it differentiated Cisco from everyone, and it's the courses that are taught at Stanford and Harvard now about how do we do it different than our peers. And it is learnable, and it goes back to young people. You can really, if you give them a chance to learn, they're like sponges. And so now being a mentor to them and a coach is what I love doing.
John, I'm a full-throated capitalist, but I have started to take the opinion that there's not enough oxygen in the markets right now. There's a big debate, as you know, going on about competition in the market, late-stage capitalism. Some have called it other things that are not quite as nice. Where are you on this? As a business leader, as somebody with such a career, how do you see the state of capitalism right now and doing business in the United States?
Three ways. First is I think the tax policy changes were well overdue, and I think they need even more focus for small to medium business. Secondly, once our country decides to put a person on the moon, we do it. Right now, we are not being aggressive enough in terms of startups and small companies getting bigger. It's confined too much to Silicon Valley, L.A., Texas, New York type of approach. I think we've got to become a startup nation and realize that we're getting disrupted on it. In terms of your indirect question, tech for good or tech for bad, it's a struggle. For 20 years that I was at CEO of Cisco, it was always tech was for good, and we worked with Washington, worked with Democrats and Republicans, got along great in Europe, got along well in Asia, even with issues on concerns over security, et cetera. I think it's very important that leadership now builds those bridges and focuses on creating jobs, not giving people stipends, and focuses on keeping the trust of their customers and of government leaders. I think Mark Benioff does a very good job of that as an example at Salesforce.com. But I think we're all aware that many Americans now no longer view tech as necessarily in their best interest, more likely to displace their job than it is to create one for them. We got to go fix that.
John, you got the direct question and you got the subtext, too. So that's why I like working with a pro. All right, John. Last question. Any advice for Facebook?
I think it was interesting. Jack Welch taught me this early on. He said, you're more product of how you handle your setbacks than your successes, and you never have a great company till you've had a near-death experience. This is when leadership has to stand out. And many companies, small and large, when they really get knocked down hard, which Facebook clearly has, don't come back. So I think this is the chance for leadership to say, all right, how much of this was self-inflicted? How much of it was market-driven? Here's my plan to get better. Outline a 3 to 5 to 10 year plan because it will take that long. Here's what we're going to change, and you can count on it. Get people regular updates on it. Re-earn the trust of the employees and the customers, and I think they can come through even stronger. But I think it is all about leadership, and it's not a given that that will happen. And like I said, most companies, when they do fall, they struggle to come back.
Would you have gone to Europe and London today to talk with the leaders of the EU, or would you have refused like Mark Zuckerberg did and send somebody in your proxy?
Well, I think to talk about one individual makes it very hard. First, overall, I went to any time a government leader wanted to talk to me, I went. But I didn't wait for them to ask us to come. We started to build the relationships with the government leaders 2, 5, 10 years before they came into power. I followed the leaders in China that were most likely to be in the Politburo and identified them on a measles charter across their country that way. Same thing in Europe. We built the trust relationships, even though we at times disagreed with the European regulators. And we always work with Democrats and Republicans together, and we were very visible there. And I was very honored to found TechNet with John Doerr. So I think it is so important that leaders be visible. I think it's so important to get proactive. It's so important to give back. People have to view that we create more jobs than we destroy, and we've got to be very careful about saying that will give you a reward if you're stifled, if your job gets displaced. People in West Virginia don't want that. So I think overall leadership, general message to people in the Valley is be accessible by government. We realize they have very fair concerns. And if you're not, government will regulate you or worse. And so I think there's a tug of war going on, and I tend to be more in the Benioff school in terms of how to approach that.
John Chambers, Chairman Emeritus and former CEO of Cisco, author of Connecting the Dots. If you're in a C-suite or you want to get to a C-suite, you need this book in your office. If you can make Kanawha Valley into a Silicon Valley, John, your legend will grow and grow and grow.
Yeah, we're going to start at Morgantown with the universities because that's where startups like to be. They like to be around the university, and Gordon Gee there, I think, can play a key role. So go Mountaineers, and Jason, it's a pleasure to see you, a graduate of 1993.
This has been my great pleasure, John. Thank you for your time.
My honor. Have a great day.
That was John Chambers, former CEO and Chairman Emeritus at Cisco. John and I are both from West Virginia, and toward the end of that interview, I mentioned a place called Kanawha Valley. That's an area near the capital, Charleston, that was for decades one of the global hubs for chemical manufacturing. The place has since gone into steep decline. Coal and chemicals were the two economic lifelines for West Virginia, and without proper or forward-looking strategies, the state is now near the bottom in nearly every economic category except the age of its residents. John's new book is titled Connecting the Dots. For links to the book and John's legendary career in tech and his new venture capital enterprise, check the show notes for this week at KGORadio.com. And that's going to do it for this week's show. We hope you liked the guest and the subjects as much as we enjoyed putting them together. For this and all of our archived podcasts, you can check iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Audio Boom, just about everywhere you get your podcasts. Just keyword search Techonomics. We are also online at several convenient locations near you. KGORadio.com/Techonomics, Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio, and I'm on the Twitters. I'm at KGO Jason. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. Thanks again for listening, and have great weeks, everybody.